Hi, everyone, and welcome to Dev Raga Personal Finance. My name's Dev Raga, your host. And in this episode, we have a very special guest. We really needed someone who's an expert when it comes to will and estate planning. I know I've done a couple of episodes on this about the basics in terms of what a guardian is, what a will is, all that sort of stuff. But we really need someone who knows what they're talking about, who actually practices law in this field. And I reached out to Marley Vieira, who's from Ness Legal in Thornbury in Melbourne, and she accepted to come and do a couple of episodes. In the first episode, we're going to do about estate planning itself, and immediately after that, in the next episode, we're going to do the administration of that estate. So without further ado, welcome, Marley. Thanks for joining Dev Raga Personal Finance.
Thanks for having me, Dev. Glad to be here.
Marley probably, I'm not sure whether she knew before this, but Marley actually did my will and estate planning and my wife's will and estate planning. That's the disclosure. And I didn't disclose that to her prior to the episode because, you know, it wasn't really necessary. But I think we need to disclose that. And it just turned out that you responded to my email to come on the show. So thank you very much.
No, absolutely happy to. And I did remember. I did recall your name. So I do remember you and your wife.
could have been the email because I used the same email to invite you as well. Yeah. All right, Marley, are you ready to get started?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, let's get started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Now, if you're new to this channel, remember the three main aims: education, empowerment, and entertainment. And if you want to contact me, if you have any specific questions, don't hesitate to contact me via Facebook or by Twitter. That's probably the two most common ways people contact me. Email, not so great. And let's sort of ask some questions about will and estate planning. So, Marley, obviously, tell us a little bit about yourself. You are a lawyer that specializes in will and estate planning. So how do you become a lawyer that does that if you've got an interested, I guess, year 10 student listening in?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm one of the senior wills and estate lawyers at Ness Legal. I've been practicing in this area for almost 8 years now, which seems like a long time when I say it out loud like that. Honestly, when I finished year 12, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I thought maybe law, I thought maybe teaching, got into both, but chose the path of being a lawyer. So I also had an arts degree up my sleeve, so 3 years of that, 3 years of law. And then in Victoria, at least, I should say that I'm in Victoria. So you have to do a traineeship, a diploma of legal practice to become a qualified lawyer, and then get admitted at the Supreme Court, which is a great day.
Right. So essentially, just to clarify, you do year 12 and you get into law school, in your case, law and arts, which is a six-year program, or did you do three-year pre-law and then three-year post-grad?
I did three and three, but you can do a double degree over, okay. I think it's 5 years.
Yep, no worries. So you do that, and I'm going to try and use the medical analogy here. Then you finish law, you get your degree, then the equivalency of an internship for doctors, what's that in law?
Yeah, so you do this graduate diploma of legal practice, and there's a few different providers in Victoria that you can do that through. Or alternatively, if you get a graduate job, you can do it as part of your employment with them. It used to be known as articles. People would be employed as an article clerk until they had achieved that.
Okay. And then you do that for about 12 months, is that right?
Yeah, 6 to 12 months, depending on the program.
Okay. And then you've got to apply formally and get recognised as a fully fledged lawyer by the Supreme Court.
Yep, that's right.
And is that when they say you get admitted to the bar, is that what it means?
Yeah, I mean, you're admitted as an Australian legal practitioner, but yeah, you swear the oath, you sign the roll, it's a whole sort of lovely ceremony, and you have to have a lawyer move your admission, which means you get up there and say that you think that this person is fit and proper. I was lucky enough to be asked to do that last year by two of my colleagues, which was awesome. It's a big honour to be asked to do that by a junior lawyer.
Right. It's almost like, you know, getting a bit of a blessing from your seniors to be able to get admitted.
Yep.
And then how do you then become a will and estate lawyer? Is there additional training or do you sort of go into that field straight up if you want to, for example?
Yeah, I mean, I knew that I wanted to work with people. That's where my strengths lie. So I applied at a firm that practiced in wills and estates, family law and property law. And I thought I wanted to be a family lawyer, and I did that for a while, but it wasn't for me. I felt much more at home in wills and estates. So I've just followed that through. If you want to, you can become accredited, an accredited specialist. One of our directors at Nest Legal is an accredited property law specialist, which is awesome. Takes about a year to do that with all the study and the exams and everything. That's probably on the cards for me in the next 5 years, but otherwise I've just, lent into just practicing wills and estates.
And I guess let's get into the profession of law. Just a very quick question before I go into wills. Can you be a lawyer anywhere in Australia? For example, if I'm a doctor, it's a nationally recognised profession. There's something called APRA. We get registered, we get regulated by a national body. Is it the same in law, or do you have to go and do an equivalency in another state if you want to, let's say, live in Sydney or Brisbane, etc.?
You need a practicing certificate. So you're admitted as an Australian legal practitioner, but every state has their own regulating body about their solicitors. So you could go and practice in another state. Law differs state to state, but you'd have to be having an active practicing certificate for that specific state.
Right. Okay. So it's state specific, which is interesting for medical students and junior doctors listening in. That's how it used to be in medicine many, many years ago when they had the Victorian Medical Board and they had the New South Wales Medical Board. And then basically what happened was they felt that was too fragmented. So they basically nationalized it. But of course, medicine is medicine. You practice in Melbourne, a heart attack, it's the same as you practice in Perth and it's the same as you practice in Darwin. But I can understand Marley's point about the actual legal points can be quite different, or just that subtleties of differences which can impact on your will and estate, for example.
Yeah. You've got your federal law, things like family law, that's a federal thing, but then you've got your state legislation.
Right. Now, let's go to having no will, because the majority of listeners, surprisingly, I'm betting, don't have one. It's actually very common in the healthcare industry that people don't have a will, which is ironic because we pronounce people dead all the time.
Yep.
That's actually part of our profession. I never once before actually knowing about wills and estate planning thought about the implications to the family about what happens after when someone dies, in addition to me doing a death certificate, in addition to breaking the bad news to the family, in addition to organising the funeral. None of the other stuff ever comes into play. So what happens in the state of Victoria? And for listeners listening in other states, we are talking about Victoria, but the concepts are similar. What happens in Victoria if you don't have a will and you die?
Yeah, this is one thing that is quite similar state to state. So dying without a will is called dying intestate. And essentially, our Victorian Administration and Probate Act sets out what happens if you die without a will. It will depend on your family circumstances, if you've got a partner, children, if you've got a blended family, but essentially it goes through a hierarchy of next of kin. Worst case scenario, it will go to your cousins. That's how far down the family tree it goes. Common misconception, I think, is that it all goes to the government. That's not true. Even though sometimes what you would want naturally, for example, me leaving everything to my husband is what I would want. That's what my will says. It's what would happen if I died without one. Sometimes it's about what you don't want to happen, right? So if you don't have a dependent and perhaps you're estranged from a parent or a sibling, if you were to die without a will, it could end up with them. So sometimes it's about just protecting that.
Right. So it's almost like an algorithmic pattern. Yep. So, you know, for example, if I died and didn't have a will, my spouse would be the first person, and then maybe my kids, and then maybe my parents, and then the uncles and aunts. But it doesn't take into account the emotions, which is what you're saying, is that, you know, maybe I don't want my uncle to have any money. Maybe I don't want my auntie to have any money. The government or whoever the legal system designed this basically just uses an algorithm and everyone has claim to it. And if I do die without a will, how long does this process, and we'll talk about it when you do have a will, but how long does this process take in order to distribute those assets using this sort of standard algorithm And who actually does it if you haven't really nominated anyone to do it for you?
Yeah, so if you don't have a will, your senior next of kin is appointed as your administrator rather than an executor, which is who you name in your will. It's going to take longer if you don't have a will, right? Because sometimes locating your senior next of kin is difficult. Proving relationships is difficult. I've had clients who have had to submit evidence to prove a de facto relationship of 20 plus years, right? Or have a loved one submit evidence to say, yes, I witnessed them being in a relationship for 20 years. So that takes longer because you've really got to prove that you are entitled to this role. Organizations such as banks can also take longer to process requests because they want to make sure they're providing information about a deceased's account to the right person rather than just giving it to someone who may have a claim on their estate as next of kin. I've also seen superannuation death claims take a lot longer as well because, again, having to prove the dependency.
Right, and we'll talk about super a little bit later in the episode because super doesn't exactly come under a will system is my understanding. And in this situation when there's no will, can anyone challenge it? So I've actually been in a situation where I did a lot of GP geriatrics, and when people don't have a will, you know, out of nowhere, out of the woods, you'd get a phone call from a person who claims to be the long lost half brother of this person who passed away, which would always get my antennas up. Can I please, Dr. Dev, have a copy of the death certificate? That would be the, you know, the most common request because they can then use that to sort of prove the death of their loved one. Always used to wonder, you know, what that meant for that family. Does that mean that this is a will challenge or challenge of intestacy, et cetera? So what happens if you don't have a will? Can anyone challenge the algorithm?
You can make a claim in the same way you could claim if there was a will, but in Victoria, you have to be eligible to make a claim. So for example, I couldn't claim on your will, Dev, because I'm not dependent on you. I'm not your child, your spouse, anything like that. So you have to be eligible, and there's the definition in the Act. You also have to be able to prove that the deceased person had a moral obligation to provide for you. And on top of that, you have to prove a financial need. So if you're the long-lost stepbrother or half-brother of someone and you're saying you're entitled to a piece of their estate, but you're a billionaire, you're probably not going to have much of a successful claim against someone else who may be less financially set up.
Yeah, it's interesting because that algorithm I did notice is very much relationship based, very much bloodline based. It's not really based on your neighbor, your friend, you know, your school teacher, all that sort of stuff. So it makes it really hard for anyone to sort of claim, you know, assets if you don't have a will. And that's even more the reason why you need a will, because if you need those sort of special people included, then you need to have a will and have an estate plan. I can get a will kit from the local news agency, maybe supermarket. Most of the listeners to this channel are above average income earners. So, but what about if you're just a standard sort of single person, average income, what are those will kits? Are they legally valid? And what's your opinion about those will kits? Is it okay to use? Because they're about $100 or something. They're quite cheap.
Yeah, I mean, you've got those will kits. You'll also probably be inundated with online wills through various services. In my opinion, you're making a will because you want to make sure that your affairs are sorted, right? You want to do what's best for your loved ones, whether that's friends, family, even a charity that you might want to look after. I think that they can give you a false sense of security. You're led to believe that everything is done and your affairs are all in place and set out, but DIY will kits, online wills, they're not being looked over by a lawyer. They're not being drafted with consideration to so many other things that make up estate planning. For example, my home, I own it jointly with my husband. So if one of us were to pass away, it just goes straight to the surviving proprietor. If I said in my will, I want to leave my house to you, Dev, that's not going to be effective, right? And that's not something that most people would be aware of, I think, without having that broader conversation with a professional and someone who deals with this all the time. Same where people gift assets that might be owned by a family trust or another entity like that. So while will kits and online wills are a little bit better because they do provide some guidance to how to set things out and they'll ask you questions, I just don't really think it's a substitute for professional advice tailored to your circumstances and your needs.
Yeah, no, good point. I mean, I see wills. I mean, I guess how long does it take to construct a will and have that discussion with a lawyer? Myself, my wife, what we sat down with you, maybe two or three sessions,
yep,
and a couple of hours each. So it did take a lot of time. And we did a fair bit of homework, email back and forth, so that we can provide, you know, a bit of a snapshot of where we want our assets to go. And I guess it's kind of like an insurance policy, right? I mean, you spend all this time and effort accumulating all these assets, which is literally the entire premise of my show, to learn about financial literacy.
Yep.
And then, you know, don't want to spend a few thousand to protect it. It's kind of like buying a really expensive car and not having comprehensive insurance. No one ever do that, because that would be silly.
Yeah.
But people don't have a will, and it is kind of an insurance that they don't have.
Yep.
So speaking about a will as a definition, what is a will by definition?
In the Wills Act, it needs to be a document in writing signed by the testator, so it's the person who's making the will, in the presence of two or more witnesses who need to be there and sign in front of the will maker themselves, okay? So that's also something really common that we see in homemade wills, is they're not executed properly, right? Maybe they're not dated because they should be dated, or there's only one witness, or one witness is signed in blue and the other black. It's going to raise questions from the court.
So that's validity, right? So you think you've done a will, but you kind of haven't. And I do remember sitting and signing all those documents in your office, and yeah, it takes a bit of time. And I do remember specifically you mentioning the color of the pen, because I think at one point I wanted to use the pen that I'd brought, but you had your own set of pens, and I went, well, let's not stuff up the color, because the last thing you want to do is make the will invalid. You did mention about an executor. What is an executor when it comes to a will?
Yeah, the executor is the person that you appoint in your will to handle your affairs and manage your estate. So they'll do everything. They'll plan your funeral, sell property if needed, collect in your assets, close bank accounts, and they'll also look after the finances for minors until they come of age.
Okay. So does every will have to have an executor, kind of? Because otherwise, I mean, who does that work?
Yeah, exactly right. If you have an executor who maybe has lost capacity or predeceased you and you didn't have a backup plan in your will, what happens is it usually passes to the person who's receiving the most in the estate, or senior next of kin. And we call that letters of administration with the will annexed to it.
Okay. Can an executor also be directly a beneficiary? Would that be a conflict of interest?
They can absolutely be executor beneficiary. That's not a problem. One of the most important things to point out when you're an executor is that you have a fiduciary duty with the beneficiaries, right? Similar to a doctor-patient relationship. So you have to act in the best interests of the estate and all of the beneficiaries equally. So you can't muddy the waters. You can't put your personal needs above that of any other beneficiary. For example, if a beneficiary wanted to purchase property from an estate, they have to do so at fair market value. They can't just get a bit of a discount or anything like that.
So just to clarify that definition of fiduciary, so let me give you an example and you tell me if this is a medical equivalent. If a patient comes and says they've got a medical problem, I can't suggest a treatment to the patient, which I can't say, oh, you definitely need this treatment, and according to the guidelines, they may not need it. And having that treatment has a direct benefit to me. I mean, classically a surgeon saying, I'm going to operate on your knee, even though it's got a little bit of arthritis, and the standard of care is 99% of the surgeons won't operate on that knee. They would just say, just some Panadol. And if you operate on that knee, that you're acting against the interest of the patient and you're acting in your interest. So an executor, so that's a legal responsibility. Is that right? So if they act in their interest, then potentially they're in trouble.
Oh, deep water. Absolutely. They could be sued by a beneficiary and removed. You know, even things like putting the value of an estate asset much lower than what it is on the inventory of assets when they're applying for probate. That's part of it.
Right. Okay. So it's a really, really big role. I mean, this is an important person in your life. That if you're going to be selecting someone for an executor, they are an important person. Can you have algorithmic executors? So for example, you did mention, what if the executor dies? So can you say, if this person is the executor and they pass away or up until this date, then the next person takes over and you can stipulate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my will names my husband. If he can't act, you know, if something happens to us at the same time, I've got my mum on there as backup. And I also think I have my brother on there even further down the line, because mum's obviously you know, older than me. So you can certainly do that, or you could say, this is my executor up until this date. And then, you know, that date might be the age that your children turn 25 and you'd be happy for them to take it on and then appoint your children.
Yeah, that's right. If you've got minor children, really important. So you mentioned about differences in state law. Can an executor be interstate?
Yeah, they can. Sometimes the court will ask for what we call a surety guarantee if they have concerns that the executor might, for want of a better word, run away with the estate because they're in a different jurisdiction. But yes, you can name executors interstate.
And likewise, many of my listeners have relatives overseas with not really anyone in Australia, particularly internationally trained medical graduates who've come here, done medical school, and then have stayed here. Can they have executors overseas back home?
They can. They'll be faced with the same difficulties. If someone was looking to appoint an executor who's overseas, I'd recommend having two executors, someone who is local. There can also be sometimes some tax consequences in having overseas executors, especially if you've got minor children.
Okay. And joint executors, good idea, bad idea? Is it just a complicated thing or?
It depends. I'm going to say that a lot today, but it depends because, you know, if you appoint two people that can't stand each other, if your kids have been feuding for the better half of 30 years and you appoint them as joint executors, you passing away is not going to change that. They're going to feud even more so. But other times it can be really useful. So especially where people have young kids, I recommend having, you know, if possible, one person from each side of the family as your backup executor so they can work together for the best interests of the kids and everyone's family feels like they've got a say and have got some input into how your affairs are managed.
Okay. What about beneficiaries? So we talked about executors, the primary person responsible for really managing your estate after your death. Beneficiaries are people that benefit from your estate. Most commonly, they're going to be kids. But it can be anyone, right?
Yeah, we have testamentary freedom in Australia to leave your estate to whoever you want, right? So you could leave your estate to the Lost Dogs Home if you want to, but you're then faced with the issues of people having claim on your estate where you've got dependents. But there's no limit to who you can appoint as a beneficiary. You can name beneficiaries or you can have a class of beneficiaries. So you could say, you know, if something happens to me, I want my estate to go to my nieces and nephews. I haven't met all of my nieces and nephews at this point. They don't exist. So, but they're still covered. You can't really do things like, I want my estate to go to every left-handed brown-haired person in Northgate, but they can be a closed class.
So you can add beneficiaries later on?
Yeah.
And you can subtract beneficiaries later on. But you mentioned something interesting. You can add things saying, you know, nephews and nieces, even though they're not born.
Yep.
So they're not in existence. Okay, so that makes it a lot easier. You don't have to keep revising the will because every time you revise a will, it costs money.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not cheap.
You can future-proof, which is good.
And you said testamentary freedom. So that means I can leave my will to the most immoral cause and the legal system doesn't mind. So I can say, which is not going to happen, by the way, because I don't smoke or drink, but I can say my will and estate can go to the tobacco manufacturing company. Or, I mean, like, you know, something like a bad, not a bad, but, you know, potentially risky sort of thing to do. So there's no moral obligation to leave your money for quote unquote good causes.
No, I mean, you could leave your estate however you want. Absolutely. But, you know, your wife would certainly have a claim.
Absolutely. Yeah. And she's probably listening in. What about wills and having provisions while you're alive and then having different positions while you're dead? Can a will ever be executed while you're alive?
Well, the will comes into effect after you die, and I know we'll chat about powers of attorney as we go, but you can, part of an estate plan is structuring your affairs so that your will can be effective how you want it to be. I've seen people do things like saying that a certain property is to be sold to cover off on debts when they, you know, when they pass away. And I've seen people stage or their kids' inheritance a bit at 18, 21 and 25. I just advise against ruling from the grave. You want there to be some level of flexibility and freedom and not be too prescriptive.
Yeah, then you kind of get stuck.
Yeah.
By being too prescriptive. You did mention about kids. So if you are dead and you've got kids under the age of 18, they can't really get your assets, can they? So basically your executor kind of holds and manages that asset for the sole benefit of those children, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. They'll hold onto it until the age that you've specified in your will. So 18 is the youngest. 21 and 25 are pretty popular. The oldest I've seen is 45. So, yeah, essentially the executor will hold onto that until that age, manage it for them. There's powers for executors to advance that child's inheritance as well, if it's for their education, health, any other things that might need to happen. So it also means the guardian's not out of pocket.
Okay, yep. And the guardian can be anyone as well, yeah? So that doesn't have to be a family member, can be a friend, neighbour, doesn't matter.
Yeah, you want to appoint someone, I think, who shares your parenting style, shares your values, someone who gets along with your children and will raise them how you want them to be raised. Guardianship is a funny one because it's not always completely concrete. And this is always a little warning I give to my clients because children, as they grow older, they have a bit of a mind of their own when you've got teenagers and things like that. So if something happens to you, your 16-year-old, whilst technically under guardianship, may not want to live with the aunt or uncle you've stepped out in your will. They might want to live with someone else. So it's up to the guardian to say, yes, that's fine. Also, family court can come into it as well. So I've seen this where maybe divorced parents and some guardian sort of keeping the kids from the other side of the family. So anyone can go to the family court and say it's in the children's best interests to see them, spend time with them and things like that.
And at what age can the child decide this? Is there like a minimum age? Like, for example, in medicine, we call it the age of consent, which is roughly around the sort of, you know, 12 to 13-year-old. It's called Gillick's competence. There's no actual age, but it sort of depends on the doctor versus the patient. And this is in relation to sensitive topics like contraception, pregnancy counselling, STI screening, all that sort of stuff. Is there a legal age where the child can say, I don't want to live with my guardian anymore?
There's no set ages, similar to what you've just described with medicine. It depends on the child and it depends on the circumstances. You know, you've got some 12-year-olds that are incredibly mature and then you've got 14-year-olds or 15-year-olds that maybe wouldn't be making the best decisions for themselves. So it just depends.
And likewise, the executor, you can have an algorithmic approach for a guardianship in case they pass away. So if you have your parents as guardians, then they're much older than you, that you can probably have your brother or sister and then younger people based on dates or based on ages or based on being alive or not.
Yeah.
Do guardians get paid? Is it a payment thing? Can they expect a payment for looking after your kids? I mean, that's a big job.
It is a big job, but it is not a paid job by default. So you could certainly add a clause in your will that says, hey, I give my brother $100,000 as a thank you for looking after my children if this happens, you know, to me. You've also got the fallback of having that advancement clause in most wills, I find, we'll have that clause. There's also optional clauses that we, you know, quite often put in our wills that allow the executor at their discretion to reimburse the guardian for any out-of-pocket expenses that they might have. And gifts can always be conditional as well. So if you've left a gift to the guardian, but when you pass away, your kids are in their 20s, they don't need a guardian, then it's invalid.
Yeah, it's a good point. And look, I mean, when you sort of select these sort of people, you know, you wouldn't think your guardian who's now accepted, by the way, tell them that they're going to be the guardian.
Yes.
That's the other thing. Don't just randomly put people in that you haven't told them. We gained consent from the guardians we've chosen. We've gained consent from our executors that we chose because otherwise what's the point? And look, it's a very noble thing to do, but, you know, you have to also think about it takes time away from their life and that, you know, they might need to work and they might need to earn an income to pay for their family. So, you know, having some sort of reimbursement scheme is probably something to factor in and consider in terms of your estate. In terms of distribution of assets, right, you've got property, you've got stocks, you've got superannuation, which we'll talk about a little bit, and you've got, you know, special items. So is it literally just listing out your items or listing out your assets and saying, I want this particular asset to go to this particular person? Or can you just sort of do a percentage basis or can you make it a lot more simpler? Because you want a will to last for several years and you don't want it to be kept on revising based on the amount of assets that you have and accumulate.
Yeah, to future-proof things, I recommend that you deal with either just the estate as a whole and work with percentages. Most people will do say, alter their spouse, alter their children, and just leave it at that. So it doesn't matter if you buy and sell assets. If you want a specific item to go to someone, absolutely, you can leave that in your will. It'll be binding. You're faced with a redemption if that asset is sold or lost. So usually try to lead clients away from that where possible. Often you'll see things like gifting engagement rings or heirlooms or art, and that's fine. We have also developed, we call it a workbook or a letter of wishes, which is where you can set out, have it sort of be an instruction manual for your executor and guardian. So rather than have it binding black and white in the will, have it as an extra document, refer to it in the will, lead your executor there. It's non-binding, but it's persuasive and it provides your executor with a bit of context about what you might like. Something as simple as, I want my best friend to have first pick of my jewelry before it goes to my sister, or something like that.
Yeah, so that's exactly what we did. So we kept the will and estate planning relatively generic, so it future-proofs, and I sort of recommend people review their will and estate planning. We sort of do it every 5 years or so, particularly as we build more wealth, and also particularly people in our lives change. But we also have a letter of wishes. For those listeners, so Marley and Nest Legal actually provided us with a template, and we basically just filled it out. And we noticed some of the things in that template we would have never thought about. For example, incremental payments if your kids reach a certain age and achieve certain goals. It's not binding. Religion, way of life, values. Also some, you know, personal advice. You know, mum and dad talking after they've passed away. So I think that was useful. And you know, what to do with, you know, just putting it out there. We've got a big teddy bear collection. So what to do with that? I'm not going to include that in the will, but I have mentioned a few very special teddy bears in our family that we've collected over many, many years. So those are all things I think is very, very useful. But you did say that if you wanted to be restrictive, you can bind it by including it in the will, which is also fine, but it's a bit risky. Super. You did mention super does not, my understanding is it doesn't actually come under the will. And I think it's because super is its own trust structure. You've got to have a beneficiary for super. You've got to have a binding death nomination. But there is a way to incorporate it, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can leave your super through by way of a nomination. You can leave it to a dependent, spouse, children. You can leave it to your estate, right? That's the other way to do it. So by leaving it directly to a dependent, it just goes straight to them. It doesn't matter what's in your will. It just will go straight to that person. Otherwise, by leaving it to your estate, then it forms part of the asset pool and is distributed as per your will. You can gift it specifically in your will, for example. So it can be a really good estate planning tool, especially if you are worried about your estate being claimed, a claim being made against your estate. You could say, I want my super to go directly to this person, make it binding, and as long as it's a valid binding nomination, it's protected from an estate claim.
Okay, and I remember you helped me set that up as part of the super binding nomination to make sure that it was all incorporated. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, more about wills, more about digital assets, because in this day and age, there's digital asset. For example, I've got a digital footprint. And also, we'll finish up with enduring power of attorney and medical treatment decision making. We'll be right back.
If you're after personal financial advice, don't get it from a podcast. If you would like help based on your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com, click Get Help, and we'd be happy to introduce you to one of our trusted advisors. Our panel of advisors, mortgage brokers, and accountants work with clients all over Australia so they can connect with you wherever you are. That's sortyourmoneyout.com and click Get Help.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right, we've got Marley Viero from Nest Legal talking about will and estate planning in this episode, and she'll join us in the next episode talking about administration of the will and estate post-death and the process that it takes. Now, we were talking just about the super, and just prior to the break, right at the start, we said what happens if you don't have a will and how long it takes, which can be several months in terms of getting the estate assets distributed if you die intestate, which is I-N-T-E-S-T-A-T-E, I think, isn't it? What happens if you do have a will? What's the time frame to distribute these assets? I mean, it would be quicker, but is it much quicker?
It would be quicker because hopefully the will is identifiable about who the executor is and sets out what's to happen. And if you've got, you know, quite a good estate plan, you've set out where your assets are in a letter of wishes or something like that. It takes a lot of the guessing out of it. Now, with that in mind, in Victoria, and this does differ state to state, there is a 6-month time period, and that's from the date of a grant of probate, where an estate is open to a claim. Okay, so for that reason, most executors will wait 6 months before distributing assets. I find in most cases, a year is a pretty standard time to deal with an estate from start to finish. So from someone passing away to a final distribution, including all tax matters and things like that. But this can differ depending on how, you know, complex things are. Banks usually take about 3 weeks to close accounts. Super claims, if you've got a valid nomination, the death claim hopefully won't take too long. But if there isn't one, it can take a few months, years in some cases, unfortunately. And selling property, I mean, that's just a similar time frame. But, you know, clearing out a property always takes time as well.
So it's not a quick process. No. I mean, up to 12 months, that's a significant time. That's something that I didn't really expect that long. But it's useful to know. It's not as if you're going to get everything next month. What about personal insurance payments? Because if I've got life insurance, it's going to get paid out to my beneficiary. That's another beneficiary within my life insurance plan. Does that sort of come into the will, or is that just like a separate thing?
Similar to super. So nominate your beneficiary through your life insurance company, whether that is, you know, to a dependent or to your estate. And things going to your estate are going to take longer than getting it paid directly to a beneficiary, because if you pay it to the estate, they're going to want probate before they'll release anything. Whereas if you pay it direct to a beneficiary, it's going to take less time.
Right. Okay. Do lawyers like yourself help with the process of executing a will? I mean, does the executor come to you, which is another thing. Once you do a will and estate planning, make sure you write down who the lawyer is, because otherwise the executor wouldn't have a clue. So do you then help through this process?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the other half of my job. It's quite often a question that I'm asked in wills conferences. They say, well, what happens after I die? Who do they go to? Who helps them? That's certainly, yeah, part of my job, which I love. And lawyers can be as involved as you like. Sometimes people will come for my assistance just to obtain a grant of representation, and then they'll do the rest themselves. Other times they'll want me from start to finish. They'll say, I want to be as uninvolved as possible, Marley. Just tell me when I need to sign my name. So that's fine. But yeah, here to help, absolutely.
And we will talk about administration and the process in the next episode in more detail. How do you store a will? So I've done a will, which is a really important document. Where do I keep it?
So most law firms will have a safe custody or a deeds storage, we call it. And that's where you can keep your original documents. So we've got hundreds and thousands of wills and powers of attorney, titles, all of that type of stuff. Otherwise, if you would prefer to keep it at home, just keep it in a safe place where your executors will know where to find it. Don't keep it in the junk drawer in your kitchen. Keep it, you know, somewhere filed away with your important documents. Some states have a registration service, like a central registry. We don't have that in Victoria. However, you can register it with state trustees, but it's not a, I suppose, authorised body.
So when you say register, does that mean they actually have the will, or they just have information that you do have a will so that both. People can go and say, oh, okay, Dev's got a will, and they've actually got the actual will there, do they?
Yeah, with state trustees, it's both. So you can either just use the service that says my will is at Nest Legal, or alternatively you can store your will with them.
Okay. Is that free, or do you have to pay for it? I mean, I'm assuming there's a payment.
I'm not sure off the top of my head, but I would assume that there's a payment.
Yeah, nothing is free in the great state of Victoria, I should say. What happens then if the law firm goes bust? So the law firm has the will. I've got the will. I'm assuming the will is still valid. What happens then?
Yeah, another really great question and a common question that's asked in wills conferences. If that were to happen, you'd be notified by the law firm to say, okay, we're shutting down. Your documents can be collected by you by X date, or alternatively, they're going to go to a new law firm. So deeds are quite valuable and are sold to other law firms who will then hold them in their safe custody storage. The Law Institute and the Legal Services Commission have a way to trace that. They'll have records of it. So if you did never get the email or the letter saying we're shutting down and you have no idea where it's gone, you can get in touch with them and they'll provide more information. But that's why it's important to keep your lawyer updated with your details as well, numbers, emails, addresses. Put your lawyer on the list of people that are contacted whenever you change any of those things.
Yeah, so obviously if you change addresses, change mobile phone numbers, you have to tell three people, doctors, lawyers and accountants.
Yep.
Because because at some stage, an accountant may need to get in touch with a lawyer, and at some stage, the doctor has to do a death certificate. What about testamentary trust? Can you explain what that is? And is it a 100% always do thing, or is it just an optional thing which is incorporated in your will?
It's an optional thing, although I consider it to be the Rolls Royce of wills. So it's a more sophisticated type of will. It's legally sophisticated. And it's got the three main benefits that differ from your standard will. So the first thing is asset protection. So protecting in the event of maybe a relationship breakdown, or you've got a beneficiary who is perhaps a business owner who might get sued. The other is tax effectiveness. You can stream income down to lower income earning members of your family. And the third one is that it gives your beneficiaries the option about whether they take their inheritance absolutely, so in their own name, or if they establish a trust that they will manage themselves if the circumstances are allowing of that, and have that asset protection and tax minimization.
Right. Okay. So essentially, to give you an example, if someone dies and they've got beneficiaries, those assets, if they've got a testamentary trust, that testamentary trust is only active upon my death or the person's death, right?
Yep.
And then those assets go into a trust for that beneficiary for the sole purpose of protecting that asset against any potential claims from outsiders. And so I can think of a classic situation where you might have children who grow up and get married and you've passed on, so your assets and index and ETF portfolios and stocks are in that testamentary trust, and then your child gets married or gets in a relationship with someone. That someone happens to be not a very nice person, but if you have a testamentary trust, the assets belong to your child. So that outsider, that person that they've married or had a de facto relationship, don't really have access to that assets. Is that a reasonable scenario,
yeah,
or not really?
I mean, it's more that the assets are held by a different entity that the will establishes. So think of the trust as a completely different entity. And what the will does is, upon a relationship breakdown occurring, it removes your child as the person in control of that trust for that period of time. So then in the event of a nasty separation in court, the court hopefully won't claw through those assets and say they should be split between, you know, your child and their now former partner. So that's the main asset protection thing there as well. Also really useful if you've got a child who, say, is a a spendthrift or has, you know, an addiction issue or something like that, or another form of, you know, incapacity or disability. And you can set up the same type of thing.
Right. Okay. Yep. No worries. And if you have three children or four children, it's not just one testamentary trust. It's a testamentary trust for each of those child with specific assets in that trust.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can have a separate trust for each beneficiary, which is probably most common because then each beneficiary, when they're old enough, will control their own trust. Sometimes we do trusts that are for multiple beneficiaries in the one trust, but that can be a little bit messy. It would depend on the right circumstance.
A little bit risky, yeah. You got to have a cohesive family, I suppose.
Exactly.
And the executor then is still responsible for kind of administering and maintaining that testamentary trust up until a set age that you specify that the assets can then be formally distributed to your child.
Yeah, they're the trustee. Okay.
Now, one of the things that I want to mention is just a PSA to listeners, and having been involved in, you know, dealing with very complex family situations when their loved one dies, it's actually pretty amazing how ugly things get. That's one of the things that I've realized as a doctor, is that you would think that if your loved one has passed away, you would think that the families are grieving, everything's hunky-dory, just like in the movies. That actually doesn't happen all the time. I'm actually very surprised how families have very ingrained conflicts that really boils up and comes out during the grieving process. And as healthcare workers, we've got to be sensitive to that because you'll see it in the hospital or the aged care where someone's died. And the expectation is the partner or the spouse or the children all come together and are hugging each other and kissing each other and making sure that everything goes smoothly. I've been involved with a lot of ugly situations, and you sort of go, oh, this is a bit awkward, because at the end of the day, we've got someone who's passed away, guys, and, you know, we got to get on with things, and I've got to do a death certificate, and I'm actually really uncomfortable trying to deal with one part of the family and then trying to deal with another part of the family, and each of them want to talk to the doctor. Surely it must be the same experience for you as a lawyer. You would have seen some disaster cases when it comes to administering wills, right?
Oh, 100%, and that is something that is always at the front of our minds, because conflict of interest, right? If you've appointed an executor and I'm acting for that executor, I can't go and give a beneficiary advice about the estate. Even if that executor is also a beneficiary, if I act for them in their executorial capacity, I can't act for them in their capacity as a beneficiary. So it does make things difficult, especially if you've got, you know, rogue beneficiaries who are maybe calling up saying, where's my money? Where's this? Where's that? I can't talk to you about that type of stuff. So yeah, definitely experience it all the time.
Interesting. Yeah. Lastly, before we finish up this episode, what about digital assets? I mean, I'm not really talking about cryptocurrency, which is actually, you know, monetary. I'm talking about my Hotmail account, my Gmail account, my Facebook account, my Insta account, my LinkedIn profile. How does that work? Are they actually assets, or is that something that I include in the letter of wishes?
Yes and no. So definitely include information about that in your letter of wishes. But every digital asset provider will have their own terms and conditions about what happens when you die. So Facebook and Instagram, for example, they'll have a deceased estate manager. So you can actually appoint someone who will look after those assets for you, those digital assets for you, if you die. And that could be a different person to your executor. If you've appointed your mum as your executor and you know that she's hopeless with anything technical, you could just appoint, you know, a sibling or a friend to take that on instead. Similar with email accounts, they'll have inactive user policies and you can nominate who you'd like to look after that in there. But yeah, the digital assets register is part of our letters of wishes, and that's where you can say, delete my social media, delete my emails, all of the other things, yeah.
What would be really cool is by the time I pass away, hopefully my podcasting career goes on. And the way I would envisage that would be artificial intelligence, utilizing all the information that I've done so far and just basically recording episodes and just releasing them. How cool would that be? It's a bit like Tupac after he dies, his albums keep coming out. So So hopefully I'll live long enough to be able to do that. Right. So that's interesting about digital assets. And what would be really cool for me is that using artificial intelligence to keep releasing episodes in the future, a bit like Tupac releasing albums after he's passed away. Before we finish up this episode, EPOAs and medical treatment decision makers, what's the main difference between an enduring power of attorney and a medical treatment decision maker?
Yeah, so these are active when you're alive, whereas the will only kicks in after you've died. This is active when you're still alive and well. Your EPOA, or enduring power of attorney, that is dealing with personal and financial matters, okay? And this is different state to state. So if you're in New South Wales or Queensland, don't come for me on this. But so in Victoria, it deals with personal and financial matters. Personal things could be deciding where you live, who you live with, services you have access to, and then your financial decisions could be as large as selling property or using your money to pay for things for you. Medical treatment, that is specifically appointing someone to make medical treatment decisions for you if you can't. Okay, so another key difference is with the enduring power of attorney, you can set out when it comes into effect. Okay, so you can say immediately, so when you sign the document, it's active. Alternatively, it could come into effect only if you've lost capacity and a doctor confirms that. Whereas the medical one, it's only if you can't give consent to any medical treatment. You can also do general powers of attorney in Victoria. The key word being there that it's missing the enduring part of it. General powers of attorney cease upon loss of capacity. So, for example, my dad did a general power of attorney because he was going to be overseas and not contactable, and he wanted to bid on an auction. So he appointed someone to bid on that auction for him. General power of attorney was only active for a 2-day period, but that auction weekend, and then it ceased.
Right. Okay. So with the medical, it's only if you're incapacitated. So that's by default. You don't have to specify that, but with financial, you kind of have to specify. Otherwise, if it's enduring, the person that is your power of attorney can make financial decisions even when you're even when you do have capacity,
yeah,
basically.
That's right.
That's interesting. What about advanced care planning? This is something that comes up in medical talk all the time. I talk to my patients every single day. Is that different to a medical treatment decision maker? Because advanced care planning is so common, it should be so common nowadays.
I agree. It should definitely be so common. It's a different document, but I think they go hand in hand. So while the decision maker document just sets out who is making these decisions for you, the advanced care directive is where you put in any health concerns you might have currently, what your values are, what is important to you if you are, nearing the end of your life. And it's so, so important. And I encourage all of my clients to get them. We provide them the templates to our clients. However, we can't sign them. They, as you're probably aware, Dev, it has to be done by a doctor.
So, but an advanced care plan, my understanding, is not a legal document, right? It's not like a legal thing, whereas a medical treatment decision maker is a legal document.
Yeah.
Okay. What about organ donation? I'm an organ donor. I think it's really important. What is the best thing in the world to do, apart from having all this money, to give the gift of life? So does that mean my medical treatment decision maker, when I become incapacitated, can they then overrule that? Can they say, nah, I don't want Dev's organs to be donated, even though I've made a conscious decision while I'm alive?
Yeah, this is a really good question. The best way to make sure that your wishes are carried out with regard to organ donation is to sign up on the register, because your medical treatment decision maker can pretty much make any medical decision for you, except for a few things. So they can't make any decisions relating to your fertility, anything that will permanently affect your fertility or terminate a pregnancy. They can't do any unnecessary treatment. So if you were having a knee operation, you couldn't wake up and be missing a kidney or something like that. And they also can't do the voluntary assisted dying that we have in Victoria. That's a decision you need to make while you have capacity. So, sign up as an organ donor if that's something that's really important to you so that your wishes are carried out in that regard.
Right, okay. And in terms of medical treatment decision maker, if you have someone who's got a disability, particularly people that can't make decisions, children as they grow up with intellectual disability, for example, or diverse diverse neuro conditions. Does that also, like you mentioned about fertility specifically, and I don't want to dwell on this too much, but so even then, if the patient can't make the decision, how would that work? Because in terms of fertility and those sort of decisions.
Great question. And that is, you know, that's a real like a medical sort of law area. So I'm not entirely sure about the answer to that one. It is definitely a very complex area. And I did study medical negligence in university as an elective, and it's fascinating the types of things that people can and can't do.
Yeah, it's interesting because as a doctor, the first people that you go to for people with who can't make a decision is their next of kin, particularly with children and people with disabilities or intellectual impairment. So we don't really necessarily ask them, do you have a medical decision-making power, like a legal document? But it's interesting. It's probably something that we probably should, particularly when it comes to really challenging decisions, you know, blood transfusions, operations, you know, fertility treatment, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, it generally does go to your next of kin. I should have mentioned that, sorry. It does go to your next of kin. VCAT can also appoint guardians as well, which can be someone who makes decisions, medical decisions on behalf of someone who can't.
Yeah, I've had to go to VCAT a few times for decision-making for medical when it comes to particularly GP geriatrics, where a lot of them outlive everyone else and there's no one else to make that decision. Is a medical treatment decision-maker form the same as a medical power of attorney? Is that the same thing?
We don't have medical powers of attorney in Victoria anymore. That was under old legislation. I think it changed around 2015 or 16. But they're quite different documents. But, yeah, completely new legislation.
Right. And before we finish up this episode, how often should someone update their enduring power of attorney, medical treatment decision maker, will and estate? How often do you think is a good time frame that you should review all this just as a general review?
Yeah, I think every 3 to 5 years, review everything. You don't have to update if nothing needs to be changed, but at least read through it all and make sure that it is current. Powers of attorney are funny documents because you can't have too many backups in it, right? And that's the legislation saying that. So with that, if you, for example, have young kids, maybe that you haven't appointed them, you know, in the outset because they're minors. So I would definitely consider reviewing that once they're adults. It doesn't have to be when they're 18, but could be, you know, when they're 25, 30 and you want to put them on there.
Yeah, fair call. So that's it for this episode, which is about will and estate planning. We covered a fair few scenarios and a fair few topics. In the next episode, we will cover how to administer, what actually happens when you die, what's the processes, and there are some key definitions about probate. You did mention that during this episode. So thank you very much, Marley. We'll progress on to the next episode. Now, if you want to leave a 5-star review, Marley especially will, but everyone else listening in, definitely do so on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you may be using, or just leave it on all of the platforms. That's even better. And please leave a positive review because it really helps the algorithm in terms of promoting the episodes. And a lot of this is about education. A lot of this is about literacy, about finances, and in this particular case, will and estate. Now, until next time, please make sure you get a will and estate plan going, and please make sure you stay safe. This is Dev Raga from Dev Raga Personal Finance, and I'll see you next time.
We acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we live and work and pay respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to this podcast. This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation, or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement, target market determination, and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. Simo Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, and Glenn James are authorised representatives of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451289.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.